Good afternoon. So, last time, we talked about the logistics of the final challenge assignment and the final. As I mentioned last time, I'll have that released by Friday, hopefully tomorrow. Along with some reference solutions for prior assignments. And then we also talked about more about sandboxing. And one issue that came up with sandboxing was that, well, we were talking about these ways of running applications where we would filter their system calls, but the system call interface is actually pretty big. It's often pretty hard to enumerate the available system calls not the available ones, but the ones that the application cares about, and figure out, you know, what we actually need. And it's easy to miss sort of these obscure features. We saw this example with the Docker escape. That was a bug. I call it the runc bug because runc is the name of the component that was running something in a container, where there was this feature that they missed, which is that you can, for, you know, like debugging and diagnostic purposes, you can read executables that are in the container, and there's a way of using that. And that's the sort of thing that we need to worry about because there's so much stuff that system calls can do and so many ways they can do it. And it's one reason why people might not trust this sort of thing so much. If you think about it, for example, most of the major quote-unquote cloud computing providers, you know, don't use this type of isolation between users because of these issues. We also mentioned the challenge of programs using these shared services. So, like, if we're thinking about a program that displays something on the screen, often there's another program that manages the things that are on the screen, and these programs need to talk to that program, and that's kind of like another set of system calls that we need to filter that's also going to be large and complicated, because probably, you know, just because we want to allow an application to display something on the screen doesn't mean we want it to, for example, be able to capture all the key presses from other applications, so we need to make sure we're restricting that. And one thing we found out when looking at the system call interface is that the mechanisms we had for filtering system calls didn't actually work very well for controlling access to things like files, because we would need to, like, do all this tracking to figure out, like, what file is being accessed. And often the operating system can help us out of it here by letting us have some mechanism for more directly saying what files can be accessed. And we saw sort of two versions of this. So one was this idea of mandatory access control. So we can go beyond the sort of usual permissions that we set on files and have a system where we mark files with types, and we can tell the OS, here are the things this application is allowed to do. And this we would call mandatory access control if it's, you know, a list of allowed operations. So we don't have that problem we had initially when we were talking about, you know, just run it as a different user, that there's not going to be these shared resources that maybe we don't really want a malicious program to access, because we can limit that. And this would be enforced in the OS, which means that whoever wrote the OS needs to go through all this effort of kind of modifying every place where we try to use a file and making sure we do a check against this list somehow. Another version is that we can have sort of a different view of system resources. So for files, we can have a different view of what files are accessible. And we saw probably the simplest version of this with chroot, where we tell the programs that here are the available files, but what we did is we made a directory of files we wanted the program to be able to access and said to the OS, make this the set of files that the program thinks exist on the disk. And the implementation of this is just that we keep track of the root directory for every single application, and some applications might have a different one. And this provides a way where we're not going to accidentally skip this check. It's not very complicated to implement in the OS, because basically rather than needing to add some extra checking every time we use a file, we're just changing the lookup a file operation to look at the current process and figure out, well, if it's this process, what file is it? And, well, files that the program's not supposed to access just don't exist. Now, the chroot mechanism had some flexibility issues. And one of these was that we couldn't easily, run an application without kind of duplicating everything on the system. That it was nice if, like, we wanted to run a second copy of our system, but usually for sandboxing, we want something kind of in between. And also, this required privileges to set up because we were worried about confusing privileged applications that, might look for a configuration file in a particular place. And we don't want to make it the case that you could run one of those privileged applications and have it be confused and use that configuration file and be able to do stuff it's not supposed to be able to do. So for the problem of not being able to easily set up these environments without duplicating everything, we saw this idea of, taking advantage of the Unix mechanism for mounting, where if we're just talking about plugging in a disk to a machine, on a Unix-like system, this appears as a directory. And we can reuse that mechanism by having the OS support what Linux calls bind mounts, where we make a directory that from somewhere on an existing file system appear somewhere else, the same mechanism we use to make just a whole disk appear somewhere else. We're using that same internal support, but we're using it to let us sort of set up aliases for parts of the disk. And this allows us to set up that sort of subdirectory without duplicating everything. And we can combine this with the idea that we're going to have each application have their own view of what the mounted things are, what directories correspond to disks, which we called a mount namespace because we call the operation of setting something to be available looking like a directory a mount. And in this way, we can kind of set this up and not be worried about interfering with other applications on the system. And if we can have this separate view for sort of what directories correspond to disks and the like, we can have a separate view for other resources, like process IDs, the networks, we mentioned user IDs. And this allows us to have different processes running on the same OS. You just sort of have a different system that they're working with, even though they're sharing the core of the OS. So, if we take this to, you're doing this for all these resources, we can kind of create this very lightweight VM where, it's lightweight because we're not duplicating all the OS resources. We aren't having multiple copies of all the files like we would if we used a traditional virtual machine, but we're achieving the same sort of effects. And the OS implementation isn't that bad because basically we're changing the lookup operations that when we look up, where what things are mounted, rather than looking in a global, we're looking in something pointed to by the current process. When we're looking in what processes are there, rather than looking up in a global list of processes, we're looking up in a list pointed to by our current process, and so on. So it's not a big change to make sure that this happens consistently in the OS. So questions about these things we covered last time? Okay, not seeing any. Okay. So at the end of last lecture, we went through this bug that was in Docker where, they missed that you could access the current executable of a program. So there, run something in this container, this lightweight virtual machine command ended up, having this bug where you could modify the run something program because it was accessible in that container. And I want to show another example of this sort of problem. So this problem here, you know, way we can think of it is that there's this kind of unexpected interface that we needed to disable. And in this case, the interface was that we could access executables that we were running, you know, even if their files wouldn't normally be accessible to us. Another example of this occurred with a bug that was reported against the SE Linux sandbox, and it turns out a whole bunch of other things that were trying to sandbox applications, but SE Linux is probably the most notable of these tools. And this is the bug report that was sent. And the problem here is, again, an issue of, you know, you had to really know what system calls allow in order to set up that filter. And what they missed is that there is this IOCTL system call, which is used for all sorts of operations for configuring devices and terminals and so on in various ways. So it takes an argument, which is a file descriptor. In this case, this is the terminal, and an operation, and an argument. And on Unix-like OSs, there's a type of file which represents what's called the pseudo terminal, which is the thing that is used to communicate between your terminal program, the thing that displays your terminal, and the programs running in it. And this has a buffer that's managed by the OS. And normally we just think of it, well, that your terminal program writes to that buffer and the program you're running reads from it for, you know, sending your keyboard input. But it turns out that there's this system call for, which is, you know, add something to the input buffer. That's just an operation that's supported. And SE Linux, well, they weren't actually doing system call filtering. They were making that list of allowed operations. And they said, well, of course we're allowing people to do operations on the terminal they have access to. Why would that be restricted in the sandbox? That's something they need to do to run. And they missed that. Well, there's this operation maybe is not so great. Because what it lets them do is that you run this application in the sandbox tool and it types a command for you and runs it because it types it with the new line here. So, obviously, SE Linux fixed this, but this shows sort of the sort of things that even people who, like, clearly know a lot about the internals of the OS can miss these very large, you know, holes that are kind of logic errors. They're not like the kind of exploits, you know, we spent a lot of the semester on where there's some sort of obvious thing which maybe should segfault or something. This is just you missed an operation that you should have filtered, or you accidentally included it on the list of allowed operations because you were like controlling the terminal settings. That makes sense. Questions about this? Okay. So we went over a bunch of sandboxing mechanisms, and sort of saying that, well, sandboxing has some real deployments that are not just our example. We give the example of Docker, for example, but there's some sort of more popular deployments that are everywhere. So one example is Android. So the Android OS, well, it runs applications in a sandbox. And this is something that's a lot easier to do in a mobile OS than like a desktop OS, but some desktop OS tries, and we'll talk about that next. And, you know, how does the Android sandbox work now? Well, now it's both SE Linux and Seccomp. So it has a system call filter. It has a system call filter that's not the fully restrictive version, You know, so with custom, you know, rules to handle what should and shouldn't be allowed, and this is how they actually filter out, you know, what applications can do and enforce the, you know, permissions that you can see in when you have an Android app, and, you know, making sure that they have to, you know, have user permission to do certain operations. So probably the next most prominent example of operating systems trying to sandbox applications besides the mobile OSs is something that OS X started doing, especially when they were popularizing the Mac App Store, is that they tried to have most of the Mac App Store apps have a sandbox that they run in that does system call filtering. And we mentioned that, well, the big problem with system call filtering is that, you know, it's hard to, like, make it meaningful for a typical application a user runs. Because if we think of, like, my media player, well, of course my media player should be able to open practically any file I have, because that would make sense. And if my media player, like, can convert between formats, of course it should be able to write to practically anywhere in my directories. But that's not really something we want to allow. Like, it seems like if our sandboxing mechanism was, you know, the application can't, like, configure devices, but it can write all your files, you know, for most users, it's not a meaningful distinction. And OS X has this really elegant solution to this problem, which is that when an application that's sandboxed in OS X wants to open or save a file, well, it's going to show a dialog for the user to say where to open that file from or where to save that file to. And OS X has an OS service that displays the file open dialog. And because of this, the service knows what file the user chose. And OS X keeps track of what files the user has chosen to give the application access to. And it just keeps track of basically this list of files that we know this application has been allowed to access. And if it's not on that list, we don't allow it, but those files are the one the application is allowed to access. So we have this very implicit configuration of what files an application can access that matches the user intent in a very elegant way, because we have this OS control of the file open dialog. And, well, the application could try to display its own, but it doesn't have access to those files directly. You know, so it's serving this role of both, you know, being what the user wants to do to actually find a file, and also sort of giving the application permission to open the file implicitly. And this sort of solution, when you can do it, seems like probably the best way of dealing with the question of, like, how do I figure out what an application should be allowed to do? But unfortunately, of course, you know, this is not always going to be practical. Okay. Questions about this sort of sandboxing? So as another sort of real example of just whole application sandboxing, I'm going to talk about kind of a, you know, something with a not very big user base, kind of experimental, but is notable in sort of being probably on the sort of most security paranoid end of this space. And this is a sort of OS called Cubes. And what Cubes decided to do is that, especially when Cubes was originally written, which was a while ago before things like containers were really well supported, is that they said, okay, how do I run an application in a way where I trust that it's not going to do things I don't want? You know, the system call interface is really complicated. Not going to bother with that. They just run everything in a separate VM. So they're going to say, every application, we're going to make a new VM for it with a new copy of the OS. And we're going to focus our effort on making it so we can display multiple of those VMs sort of transparently in a user interface. And so that there's a way of like copying files to and from VMs or giving VMs controlled access to the same files. And they have this sort of common UI where the UI shows you which VM is running each application. So it's immediately apparent to you, you know, this is the thing I don't trust that I'm running in this window. And I know that because that window is red, for example. And so this level of paranoia means that, you know, they have a pretty high confidence that they have good isolation. Now, there have been bugs in VM isolation, but they're a lot less common, especially if you don't enable sort of some features that are designed to make VMs have less overhead to talk to the hardware. But the disadvantage, of course, is that they need to go through extra effort to handle sort of what would be pretty straightforward tasks if we were, you know, doing something like system call filtering, like copying and pasting between VMs. Well, that's something they probably want to support. That sort of requires adding this extra mechanism to send text from one VM to another. And even displaying things like requires us to have this sort of special, you know, protocol for capturing the image that the VM wants to display and putting it somewhere. And that's sort of the software they have to write. And that's going to, of course, have a lot more runtime overhead than if this were all in one common OS. But Cubes, you know, is something that exists, I think, is a good example because it's kind of the extreme of, you know, what we can probably achieve as far as, you know, something that's probably usable and achieves a high degree of isolation for unmodified or applications. So here is a screenshot where they have their sort of equivalent of a process manager here. And you notice that they have different colors for the different zones. And the windows are colored accordingly. So they match up. And also, you know, one of the settings in the VM for each of these VMs is you can specify sort of what network it has access to. So you can, in addition to, you know, restricting where it goes on your screen and what files, you have this notion of, you know, setting, you know, a different network for each application. So since we've talked about a whole bunch of sandboxing techniques, let's just do a sort of a general discussion idea. So like we have these trade-offs here, right? So, you know, we have some sandboxing techniques where we're going to be higher confidence in security. There's some where we're going to have to probably do more work to handle applications that are unchanged. Some where we're going to have performance or usability issues, because we're going to have to change something about how the application is run. If your assessment and see if we have, you know, have some idea like where these different solutions fit. So we have our chroot for files plus system call filtering. So chroot, remember, is setting this separate root directory. We have the chroot where we had these mount and user namespaces, so where we could presumably do bind mounts idea. We had this virtual machine idea you saw with Cubes, and we had that SE Linux idea of, you know, marking files with types and having this sort of allowed operation list. And I guess one thing I forgot to make an option for, but probably something that's, you know, another major consideration is ease of configuration. that's should be another concern. These are very different as far as how easy they are to configure. Okay, so maybe I have sort of, so technical difficulties with Zoom. I love it when that happens. Well, let's see if my alternate technique here works. And I need the chat window, don't I? Yeah. Okay. So, where is that window? Okay. So, I'll run this window over here. Okay. Over here. Okay. So, our poll results are that we have, hopefully people can hear me and see me. Oh, and see me, maybe. Okay. So our poll results are that we have that for security, C is probably best. And sort of the justification here is that we have the sort of simplest interface, simplest interface, to the rest of the machine. And so it's going to be easiest to make sure that it doesn't do anything unexpected. We're talking about performance. Well, we really like probably one of these two. I think I think these are probably about sort of equivalent. The system call filtering can be very, is probably not much more overhead than the system call itself. These are going to be probably, A and B are probably going to be best for our performance. If we're talking about usability, well, A here has this big usability issue that, it's hard to share files without something like bind mounts. If we have something like bind mounts, that's possible. If we're talking about usability also, we're going to have a hard time, really hard time, like sharing files with something like a virtual machine. It's probably going to be harder to like share things with other programs on the machine with something like a virtual machine, whereas this might be more natural with these cases. And as far as usability, D is pretty usable from the standpoint of it's running in this with the same files, so that's sort of the most natural to use. It's the most like the normal environment, though there's this sort of ease of configuration issue that with this kind of mandatory access control, we need to get that list of allowed operations right. And that seems like the hardest to construct of these without causing sort of unexpected behavior. Whereas here, we're kind of using this, we're going to list out what we want to access approach. Here, we're going to kind of list out what we want to access, but we're not going to have it like clearly shown as much. But these are similar. And as far as avoiding application modifications, most of you said virtual machine. I think that's the most flexible for avoiding application modifications because we can like run any OS in the virtual machine that we need to. But there's an argument for the other options that, well, maybe, if we want to think about the application working with other things on the same system, these other options are going to make that easier. So questions, comments about how this works here? Thoughts about this? And hopefully my quality is okay, even though I've switched to... Yeah, so I'm not doing video because apparently they didn't work, but I switched to the browser client because apparently the normal one just broke. Thank you. Okay, so we talked about a bunch of these mechanisms for sandboxing that really relied on sort of operating system or virtual machine monitor, which is basically an operating system support. And there were good reasons for doing this. And one is that sort of we primarily wanted to filter these requests to the OS. And another reason is that, well, the hardware helps out implementing the OS. So we want to take advantage of that, and the hardware generally provides these pretty strong protections. But there's some disadvantages to this approach. And one is that, you know, as long as we're relying on the OS support for sandboxing, we're going to have this sort of performance limit in that every time we want to communicate with our sandbox thing, there's going to have to be some sort of involvement of the OS. There's going to be some duplicated data structures because, like, we need twice as many processes. You know, if we're like doing privilege separation, for example, and also, you know, writing sandboxing that uses OS support means that we're going to have this very OS specific code, that we're going to have our application suddenly depend on a specific version of the OS in order to work, because these interfaces are relatively new and, you know, they have to change when the OS adds new features. And there's a bunch of approaches for achieving sandboxing without relying on the OS. Probably the one that you're most familiar with is something like a dynamic language virtual machine, like the Java virtual machine or the .NET Common Language Runtime, where these are sort of targeted as taking code that, you know, is intended to use in this high-level language and running it in a safe way, you know, with this idea that, you know, it's not going to have these, you know, do things it's not allowed to because, well, it's running in this sort of this language virtual machine that might be compiling to machine code, but doesn't allow certain operations. This is great if your program is written in the right language, right? If you're running Java programs, you can probably set up the Java virtual machine to run it in a way which is pretty well sandboxed, that where you can prevent the program from doing things like opening files you don't want to by configuring the Java virtual machine and how it allows file accesses, for example. But, you know, if you're thinking of code that wasn't intended to run in something like Java, this is a pretty bad option. That there's probably a way of compiling, you know, my C++ code to run on the Java virtual machine, but it's probably not very good. So there are also some virtual machines which have a similar principle, but are targeted more for C or C++-like code, and probably the most prominent example of this is WebAssembly, which I'll talk about next. A third approach, which I'm not going to talk about in detail, but I'd like you to be aware of, because it's a really nice idea and sometimes is pretty practical, is to do assembly-to-assembly conversion, that you can take assembly code that is meant to be run unsandboxed and convert it to something where you restrict its operations by converting it to assembly that has some added checks in it, basically. So one of the added checks would be, for example, that it only accesses memory in a certain region. And you can do that by just changing every load and store instruction to like do a check first. And maybe you can optimize away a few of those checks with a little analysis. And it turns out that you can do this surprisingly efficiently. So I have listed two papers here. So this first paper did it on MIPS. And the second paper did it on x86. These both, in order to achieve good performance, relied on things which were a bit peculiar to how MIPS and x86 worked. And that's sort of a common feature of these, is that it's like it's a really tight assembly hacking to get good performance out of this. But you can, you know, do this with surprisingly low overhead. We'll talk about WebAssembly because it's probably the most prominent example of this idea today. And WebAssembly is this language virtual machine specification. You know, oh, I didn't write. which is intended to be run in browsers. So hence the name. The idea is that we can take, you know, something that's C or C++ and compile it to this language virtual machine that runs in browsers in a safe way. And Clang, or Clang's backend, which is LLVM, that's the sort of part of Clang which produces machine code, has support for this, just like it has support for, say, ARM or x86. So you can take something you compile with Clang and produce a WebAssembly program instead of a x86 program. And this language virtual machine specification is designed to support C and C++, and it's designed to, run in web browsers, and it's designed to be easy to compile to native machine code. So it's not the x86 instruction set, but the instructions are the kind of thing which should have a natural translation to x86 instructions that should be easy to implement and turn into fast code at runtime. So you should get very similar to performance, but you're going to do the sort of bounds checking and limits and operations that you would expect from something like the Java virtual machine. And probably the trickiest part of, like, how do we make a language virtual machine or C or C++ is how do you do memory management? And the philosophy that WebAssembly takes is that, well, you know, we're not going to solve the problem of preventing use after free bugs or ensuring array and bounds. We're just going to isolate the problem. So we don't care if there's array out of bounds as long as they only crash the WebAssembly code and not everything else. So WebAssembly in the virtual machine layer exposes this idea of a linear memory. And this is basically a set of bytes that start at index 0 and go to some maximum. And there are these load and store instructions that something like Clang can generate that read and write from this single memory. So that sounds very much like reading from, say, memory on a real machine. But because there's this maximum, that's going to be enforced by the implementation. And maybe they can do some work to, like, make that enforcement a little faster in some cases, but that's where the bounds checking is. But they're not like doing the detailed memory management that like Java does. Like, they're not doing garbage collection. They're not keeping track of each object. They're just targeting things where the compiler will do what it usually did to manage like the heap and the stack and use this linear memory to do that. Because remember, our goal is not to, like the Java virtual machine, like to make array access is safe and so on. Our goal is to prevent this sandbox stuff from interfering with the outside. So as long as these load and store instructions don't let you go outside this memory box, it's fine. And I would say, I'm talking about this idea as far as implementing this language virtual machine, but this kind of idea is a lot of how these assembly-to-assembly approaches achieve good efficiency, is that one of the things they do is they say, we're not going to prevent like array out of bounds errors, we're just going to make sure that they stay in the program's memory, so it doesn't interfere with the rest of the system that might be running even in the same process. Now, another thing about this sort of language virtual machine idea is that you want to make sure that it's efficient and safe to execute. And part of the work here is having some careful specification of what all the operations do and how they work. So one of the things that's common in these sort of virtual machines for languages that are designed to be compiled to machine code is that we're going to have this separate sort of validation step from the actual running the code step. So when we load a WebAssembly file, there's this going to be this well-defined series of checks that it's well-formed. So after that's done, we can avoid most of those checks at runtime. At runtime, we know that like all the operators have the right number of arguments and so on, and we can just generate this straightforward assembly code for them. And the language specification tries to be very explicit So you can read the spec and hopefully implement it right every time, about what needs to be checked and when, and what things can't be checked with validation. So examples of things that are checked with validation are that instructions have the right number of operands. So WebAssembly instructions are stack-based. So if you remember 2150, like we had this RPN calculator assignment, I think, where like 2 plus 2 would turn into 2, 2 plus because we do postfix notation. That's how WebAssembly works internally. And they have a phase where they go through the program and make sure the stack won't overflow or underflow. And that's checked at load time. So at runtime, we know that's already done. We can just implement things without adding those extra checks. And the code is structured in such a way that we can check that statically. We don't like have things which do variable amounts of stuff to the stack. We check, operands that are constants, that they're right. If they're not constants, we'll have to check them at runtime. For things like function calls and branches, we have these instructions that like jump to a particular location, but rather than just allowing you to specify like an address, they only list locations in a table, which makes it both easier to do the compilation because we know where we have to support jumps to, and also easier to validate things like we always have the right number of operands on the stack. We aren't, overflowing or underflowing. And the WebAssembly instructions are written very carefully. And, I think there's been some efforts, I'm not sure where they are, to, verify that they're correct in some sense and some model. But here's an example of the specification for how you execute the return instruction. So, notice that it's written in a way where, if you're implementing a just-in-time compiler, something to convert this to machine code, it's very clear what you need to do. Of course, you'll have to figure out what these terms mean. I should say the frame represents our sort of function call on the stack. The arity is the number of things returned. And it says, what you need to check. It says what things should be true from validation, but if you have a debugging version, you'll probably want to check them anyways, and how you're going to run this operation. And once we have this sort of WebAssembly idea, this language virtual machine, we can use this as a sandboxing technique. And this is something that some people have actually, I'll give a concrete example next, where we can take an existing C or C++ library, compile it rather than using our normal C compiler, one that's going to produce WebAssembly, and call it using this. And now that C or C++ library, it's sandboxed in that privilege separation kind of way. But this is privilege separation without the effort of spawning another process or so on, but achieves many of the same effects. And an example of some recent work, I'm not going to say that this is the clear winner of how to do this, but an example of sort of what sort of interface you could provide is from this paper, RLBox, which was published last year, which tries to have this reusable tool for interacting with sandboxes, and they support multiple types of sandboxes, but they're based on this idea that we're going to compile a library and we're going to just automatically expose that library's API as, the same functions, but we're going to translate them to calls to the sandbox. So if we're using WebAssembly, we're going to call the functions in the language virtual machine. If we're using something like Chrome's sort of separate processes, we're going to turn them each into sort of commands we send over a pipe to the program. So the sort of usage that RLBox, there should be a space here, uses is that you create this sandbox object and you can create malloc things in the sandbox. So the sandbox has its own memory that you can access via these sort of wrappers. And there's this just invoke this function in the sandbox. And this is sort of like as if you were doing, instead of doing JPEG create decompress, P p-image JPEG, you call this invoke function, and, you know, it's a one-to-one substitution. And sort of this is what we can achieve with, you know, just a little work for some tooling. And, you know, notice another thing that they're doing here is they have this sort of tainted idea. So they explicitly mark things that are coming from the sandbox as tainted. So you know to do an extra check, and so they will enforce that you do some explicit operation to untaint them so you don't accidentally use something without checking that it makes sense. For example, checking that if there's a buffer size, that you're checking the buffer size. So this is the interface these authors proposed, and I would hope that at some point we have, you know, something where this is easy to use and widely used, but we're kind of just getting there. In the case of these authors, they were affiliated with Mozilla, so some of this stuff is actually used in Firefox for things like accessing libraries for doing parsing of images and video. And making sure that, you know, if the JPEG library has a memory management security flaw, we don't want it to be able to take over the browser. We only want it to be able to make the images weird. So questions about this sort of sandboxing? So I think this is where I'm going to basically finish up talking about sandboxing. I think it's probably one of the more practical techniques for if you're writing an application and you care about its security, it's something you can actually do that's proactive, that really does make most attacks a lot harder. Like, if you do it right, you can have security problems and you can turn them from sort of disasters to, well, that's an interesting misfeature. Okay. So next I'm going to talk about a related topic, which is about sort of the user interface side of things. And I'm going to start by talking about permission prompts. So one of the things we mentioned in sandboxing is we wanted to set these rules for what permissions and applications allowed to use. And this has come up most prominently to regular users in terms of mobile applications. And there's been this evolution. So here's a figure from a paper from 2016 showing all different versions of things that were actually used on Android to show like what permission dialogues. And notice that we have stuff that is done at install time and some stuff that's done at runtime. And there's been this evolution. And a big issue with coming up with these is trying to understand sort of what is an effective way of communicating to users, you know, what permissions you're going to allow. And there's a secondary issue of, you know, if we're implementing this with a sandbox, does our sandbox, you know, really provide these guarantees? You know, when we tell the user, this is going to, you know, have access to your, you know, location, or that it's not going to have access to your location, is that really true? So there's a bunch of issues with these permission systems that, you know, make them problematic. So one thing is whether applications are requesting the right permissions. And this is probably one of the reasons why there's been some movement away from this sort of at install time permissions. And that's because, well, a lot of these permissions didn't actually make sense. So in 2011, so there's a paper, things have probably changed because the permission system looks differently, and it's probably a reaction to these problems. Some people did this study of what permissions do the applications actually use. What was their technique? Well, they looked at the requested permissions, which at the time were, you know, a screen, you know, like this here, or like this probably. And they said, well, let's figure out, based on static analysis, do they actually call functions that we need that permission? And they took a sample of 900 apps and estimated that around 200 of them requested permissions that they didn't need. You might say, so why did this happen? Why were we not sandboxing things in sort of with the amount of limitation we needed? And a lot of this was kind of just a usability issue where developers, well, they're hurried. They don't really understand how things work because the documentation isn't very good. And they requested permissions that weren't right. So there were similar permissions. So developers had access network state, access Wi-Fi state. They didn't know the difference. So they request one of these that they weren't actually using. Developers didn't understand how the permissions model worked with respect to delegated tasks. So for example, on Android at the time, if you wanted to have a link to open a phone number in the call phone program, that does not require the call phone permission. The call phone permission was for if you are a calling application. But developers didn't understand that quite sensibly, right? Well, my application needs to let the user make a phone call to my support number, so I need the call phone permission, right? That's not actually how things worked. And similar, if you want to let people open the App Store to install an application that didn't need the install application permission, the install application permission is if you are an App Store. But they didn't understand that quite sensibly because that's a very subtle distinction. And there were some other issues. Another big issue was this sort of copy and paste. The developers didn't have the incentives to like actually check that the permissions were right. They just copied and pasted from a prior project and it worked. And you can see this as sort of a reason why there's been this move away from sort of requesting all the permissions in advance and towards what most of the mobile OS seem to have settled on of sort of requesting them as you go. And this is something we should think about for other domains like sort of browser applications or anywhere else where you want to like let users specify what some application or plugin or something can do. So another big issue which comes up with these sort of permission requests is whether users, you know, not developers, understand them. So developers have trouble understanding them. You might imagine that users have trouble understanding them, and they do. So let's do a poll question here. So where are my polls? Do I not have access to my list of polls? Because that would be launch. No, okay. Do not have access to my list of polls. Back. Oh, here we are. Okay. Different interface. So, these people did a study where they got some users and they told them, find and install a coupon app and walk me through your process. How many of the people in the study do you think looked at the permissions that were prompted for at install time? And note that part of the study was finding the, you know, choosing a coupon app. Okay. So most of you are extremely pessimistic. So it wasn't as bad as you think, but it was bad. 42% in an interview were aware of what the permissions were. They saw that as they were doing this process. 42% didn't know about that, didn't remember that being on the screens that they were seeing. And 17% looked at, sort of went, clicked to look at the detail of the permissions. And you might say, well, they're just installing an app quickly. But in contrast, 88% of their participants read reviews. So it's not that they weren't looking for detail about these applications. They just didn't think the permissions were important. This is sort of a big issue with, you know, having this idea that we'll just ask the users what the application should do. know, especially if you're doing it at this sort of install time when that's probably not their highest priority, and when we have this sort of noise from the application request these extra permissions, or there's a lot of things that don't matter, you know, that's not a very effective mechanism. In the same authors in the same paper, they also did this survey about what permissions meant. And they had this bank of three multiple choice questions. This was, I think, an online survey. They gave people three of them. The average score was 21%. To give an example, I'll take a not randomly selected launch. Is it close? Nope. And pull back. There we are. Here is a selected question of one of the ones they asked their participants. See how you do. Read phone state and identity. Which of these things does it allow? Okay, so we have our result here is that most of you said it allows reading your phone number, seeing who have called, and tracking applications with highest confidence going top to bottom. And the correct answer, it allows reading your phone number and tracking you across applications. It doesn't allow seeing who you've called or loading advertisements. So you can see why users were confused in this. But they did a survey and, you know, they asked a whole bunch of these sorts of questions. And the results were horrible. That, you know, these descriptions, you know, users had real trouble, you know, figuring out what meant what. You can see their results for read phone state here. You know, read phone call state, phone state and identity. You know, their users had sort of a similar sort of distribution, but not everyone figured out that that meant that you could get their phone number either. You know, it just wasn't clear what this meant to users. Even, you know, and this meant that users who might care about that, well, they don't know what's happening. They don't know what applications have access to their phone number or who can track across applications. And they asked a whole bunch of these. And the same authors in a different paper, well, the same first author in a different paper, had this sort of idea of, well, given what we know about how these permissions work, what should you do instead? And a lot of this has sort of been adapted in sort of the mobile space and is probably what you should look at if you're thinking about implementing any of these schemes elsewhere, if you need to have this sort of, yeah. And the way that that worked is that they have, is that, yeah, so she had these two principles that I think are sort of a good illustration of what, you know, are the big concerns with these permission systems from a usability point of view. So one issue is that there's this issue of user attention, that if you have too many security warnings, too much information, users aren't going to pay attention. So the advice here is that don't give users these permission prompts if it doesn't really matter. That don't ask users to do things when there's not big consequences. You want it to be the case that when that comes up, it's actually a meaningful choice. And another is that try to avoid asking for security decisions in the middle of something important. Because users, you know, if they're trying to do something, you know, and this there's the security warning, well, that's not going to help them do that thing. That's how they're going to act. That's how studies have shown users tend to act in these scenarios. So you want to avoid interrupting a user task, you know, and this installing the application is sort of where we saw that disconnect, that the user's primary task was installing the application. The security decision didn't really make sense at that time. So, you know, it makes sense that they had this problem. And also, there was all this information, you know, that's less important on their permissions that, like, didn't really communicate well to users. And what, you know, recommended here, sort of this flowchart sort of gives you an idea of, you know, one idea of recommendations. And this seems to be a lot of what sort of the modern mobile OSs and browsers for, like, browser extensions sort of have leaned towards getting closer to as far as permissions go. So, you know, the recommendation here is that, you know, if it's easily undone, you know, don't ask. You know, if it's not a big deal and it's easily undone, don't ask. Just do it. Let them undo it, you know, when they actually care. And otherwise, you know, try to, you know, only do it for severe things and, you know, ask the user when it's relevant to them, not when it's interrupting something else, you know, when you can. You know, save those install time warnings for cases where you can't ask people when it actually matters, when it has to be done in advance for some reason. So, questions about these recommendations? Okay. So, this is on the usability side of the permissions. Now, we saw here that there's this disconnect between attempts to describe these permissions and what they can actually achieve. And part of this is just that, well, we're bad at describing things. That if you want to make a permission system, you have to really put in work into figuring out how should I tell the user what I'm allowing and not allowing. That's going to require some real thought, and probably you want to, like, check with users if they actually think it means the same thing you do. But another issue is, of course, that there's going to be these problems where you're going to miss cases when you try to do the sandboxing. And Android has had a few of these, which are, I think, are good examples of ways in which these permission systems can fail, where we can just not specify things right. And it's similar to this prior SE Linux sandbox escape. There's these extra APIs that we didn't think about properly. We didn't think about how they work when setting up our permission systems. So one example from a while ago was this paper called Cloak and Dagger, where they observed that there were these two permissions that combined in a very non-intuitive way. And the permissions was one called internally in Android System Alert Window, which allows you applications to draw windows on top of the screen. This was enabled by default at the time, and, you know, seems like an innocent enough thing. And another is one called Bind Accessibility Service. So this is intended for programs that assist users who need, you know, some sort of assistive device in accessing something. But its description to users is that it lets you observe your actions and retrieve window content. It's designed to help you interact with other applications. And what you could do by combining these is you could, if there were, say, here's your mobile screen, if there's this window, if there's a permissions dialog box here with a yes button, you could draw an overlay that would be like here and here and here and here. So the only thing that, so there'd be this hole in your overlay right where that yes button is. And everywhere else, you would capture clicks, so the user wouldn't be able to see the yes button. You'd only, like, let a little bit of it show, and you could confuse the user. You know, you could get the user to interact with applications in ways you specified. And to benefit things, this would allow you to look at the window here so you could figure out what was happening as you were doing this and use this to effectively control any application. And so that was sort of one issue. And the other issue is that these sort of things, sometimes you could, for less sensitive dialogues, you could also often just control the application by drawing something over it and pretending you're just an accessibility tool. So this was sort of an oversight in the permission systems where they didn't think enough about sort of what these permissions meant together. Another example of where these permissions are insufficient is when applications are actively trying to kind of thwart the permission systems. And probably the most prominent way this has happened recently is with privacy. And we talked earlier when we were talking about information leaks of how applications, like how you might want to like look for applications taking your private data and sending it somewhere dangerous. But sort of a related issue is, what about applications that are just, you know, getting your private data when they're not supposed to? Like, if we look at the permissions on a typical, you know, mobile phone, you know, if they're supposed to ask for permission to, like, get your accounts, your email addresses, get your phone number. But applications in practice have found these workarounds where they get this information despite the permission system supposedly disallowing it. And these are usually oversights in the permission system, or sort of collusion. So we'll talk about the oversights first. So the permissions check, well, they thought we want to limit, you know, what applications can do. We have the Android API. Of course, applications are going to use the Android API to get the phone number, to get the, you know, the location, to get the, phone ID, some unique identifier for the phone. But there are other ways of getting that, and there were system calls they just forgot to filter. So for example, on Linux, if you have a network socket, there's a way of getting the MAC address, which is basically a phone ID. It's a unique address hard-coded into the hardware, like for the Wi-Fi card on the phone. You can get the Wi-Fi base station address. So there's a API for getting Wi-Fi info, but applications don't actually need to use that to get info about the currently active addresses from the machine. There's a separate API for getting that, which usually has the same information, but it's not the same thing. So, well, when they were thinking about restricting access to the Wi-Fi base station ID, well, they didn't think about it because, you know, this is just the recently seen machines. It's used to make the network work well. You know, why would we think of that? They just missed it. And another example is for location. You think, okay, well, you know, there's the API for getting the location. That's how you get the location, right? Well, some applications realized there's some other ways of getting the location. That if you have access to the photos, photos have location tags. If you look after a photo's taken, you know the location. So this was sort of one way applications were getting around, you know, this attempt at sandboxing, is that the sandbox missed some things. And, you know, these weren't as tragic as those sandbox escapes I showed earlier, but these were still cases where, you know, they just didn't think about how wide that system call interface was when they were figuring out what to filter. So another class of problems was that applications would collude with each other. So advertising libraries would say, well, if I have permissions to retrieve the phone ID, I'm going to store it in this file. And if I don't have permissions to retrieve the phone ID, I'm going to read that file. Because an advertising library is going to be contained in multiple applications. And some of those applications are going to have permission to read the phone ID, and some aren't. And this fix lets the advertising library get that phone ID all the time, effectively, as long as any one application has stored it there. And this was being commonly used, obviously, is something that sort of the mobile phone OS people don't like, but it's tricky to figure out how to prevent this in an effective way. because, you know, this sort of thing, you know, it's using the stated permissions. You need to figure out some different sort of rules for prohibiting it. So I think that's where I'm going to leave off for now. So I'll take questions before I sign off. And sorry for technical difficulties. Not sure what Zoom was doing.